Hello, I'm Alan McGuire, and this is Juvenalia, a podcast about childish things. Some pedants might point out that it's actually pronounced Juvenalia, but those people are wrong. Juvenalia is the art that we make when we're young and unformed. Juvenalia is the art that makes us when we're young and unformed. Now that sounds pretentious and made up, and it's true, I did just make it up and I'm very pretentious. What it basically means is that every 2 weeks or so I'll talk to a cool, interesting person about a book or film or TV show or whatever that was important to them as a child and how they feel about it now. So that's the gist of it. Let's go listen to a podcast. Hello, I'm Alan McGuire, the humour editor of Headstuff.org, and this is Juvenalia, a podcast about childish things. Co-host today is Ellen Tanham of Her.ie and the Internet.
Hello.
And our guest is Sarah Griffin, who is a writer and author. Her book, Spare and Found Parts, is coming out on Green Willow HarperCollins at the end of the year, and she has a food column with The Coven. Hello, Sarah.
How's it going on? Hi, Ellen.
What are you going to talk to us about, Sarah?
I'm going to talk to you guys about The Fifth Element, a film by Luc Besson, starring Bruce Willis and Mila Jovovich.
Cool.
So it's a... I watched it this morning again for the first time in a year or so, but there was a really long period where I watched it every night before I went to sleep. The score is really beautiful, and the sort of landscape of it is very beautiful, and I had a tiny telly in my room growing up, so I just used to stick in the DVD and let it roll. It's on recent watching, it's a noir. It's about a hard-nosed detective type guy.
Yeah.
Former major in the army, now cabbie, who's disillusioned and his wife's just left him, and he lives in a tiny apartment with a beautiful white cat and smokes futuristic cigarettes and regularly gets held up or robbed. And one day a beautiful, bizarre looking woman drops from the sky in a very futuristic New York into the back of his cab, speaking a peculiar language, and their adventure sets off from there. So
when did you first see it?
So my dad's a big movie buff, and my God, when I say it's around 15 years ago, I'm deadly serious. He built a home cinema into the side of our gaff. So he built it by hand. He built the screen out of a wooden frame and cloth, and he built the shutters on it to make it bigger or smaller depending on the screen or the resolution, the aspect ratio. He built a secondhand projector. He built a computer that would play DVDs because they just come out, then laser discs, and then they just came out, and then HD, and then Blu-ray. He bought a PS3 when I was working in GameStop as a Blu-ray player. And he started collecting DVDs and collecting movies. So the first time I saw it was in the side room of our house, which with a little bit of smoke and mirrors turns into a cinema. So yeah, I saw it with my dad for the first time, and I thought it was just the most fabulous thing I'd ever seen. It's a very visually striking film.
Yeah.
So,
I remember I saw it in the cinema when it came out, and it felt like the most futuristic thing I'd ever seen.
Yeah.
Like I was like 13, I think.
Yeah. And it just.
And even now, it still seems futuristic, which isn't always the case with sci-fi.
No, I mean, it hasn't dated in that way.
No.
Other aspects of it have dated, but the aesthetic is still very out of reach. I feel like a bit like the way Terry Gilliam's Brazil kind of feels, where this, and I think it's because there's not a lot of CGI used in it, and the CGI that's used in it is really light. It's done with a very light hand, and Jean-Paul Gaultier designed everything, the props, the costumes. He designed the whole thing, so the whole thing's aesthetic is very specific, and I think that is what builds the world and makes that distinct from other sort of futuristic things.
It reminded me of Metropolis a little bit.
Yeah. It's got really interesting style to it. There's a lot of weird bodies, and the creatures in it are very kind of unusual. No grey bobbleheads. Like, it's not like aliens from the future. It's
the aliens are really cool. And like, what was the name of the evil ones?
Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg.
Gary Oldman. His hair is fucking deadly.
He's amazing. I was reading about him this morning, and seemingly he took a lot of... He was playing Zorg as Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, and he didn't like the film.
No. He was doing his part as a return favour to Luc Besson for funding a film that he had done. It was like a trade out, I believe, so the story goes. But his Zorg is really interesting. His villain is really interesting because he's an arms dealer. His whole I'm not gonna say the word Trump, but he's a multi million business owner who profits from chaos and misery, and because the more trouble people are in, the more stuff they need. And he is he's a wonderful bad guy, and also he never meets Bruce Willis. They never cross paths.
That's really unusual.
He's causing Bruce Willis all this trouble, and there's so many capers and chaos and so much it's a very fast moving plot and there's a lot happening, but the bad guy never meets the hero.
That's like now when bad things happen, it's always from like a corporation at a distance, or faceless. Even how battles are fought and stuff now, because pretty much it's like there's a world war going on now, but it's all done with like drones and like dropping stuff from a distance, and it's all just kind of like clinical decisions rather than like person on person combat. It's really interesting.
It's a really interesting exercise, like sort of example of like control and where the, I guess it is kind of a comment on capitalism. Like everything is a comment. Like you know this, we know this. But there's a wonderful scene in it where he's explaining to, the actor's name has disappeared out of my head. He plays Bilbo Baggins in Lord of the Rings, Ian Holm. Yeah. He's saying to Ian Holm, plays this priest called Vito Cornelius, who discovers, or who is sort of the head of the order of the, for the want of a better word, church that worship these beings that Lilu is a reproduction of, or a human version of. And he's having this conversation with Zorg early on in the film, and Zorg is like, if I just mess things up a little, then people are going to need to buy this robot, and people are going to need to buy this robot, and oh, this happens and this person will need this. So it's a pretty on the nose.
He's not like evil, he's just very greedy. There's no
yeah, he's 100% greed, and
he's not like megalomaniacal. Yeah, the word I can't say. Yeah,
he's not clever enough.
Words. What's that word?
Megalomaniacal.
It's hard.
That's really? Two words.
Words are real stressful.
Yeah, the language.
It's a megalomaniac.
Yeah. It's a kind. He's not smart enough to be a megalomaniac.
He's, yeah. No, he's just a dick.
Yeah, he's the worst. But he is also in contact with this sort of the forces of good and evil are at play throughout the whole film, and that there's this race of incredible, like super god alien type things, or when they opened the film, they're very Gilliam looking. Actually, they're very. They're just these huge copper beings. Their design is gorgeous. And then there's an evil thing that kind of balances out the good things.
The evil things are kind of like lice, like giant bugs.
I think they're more like they're like an orc race.
Yeah.
They're evil too. There's lots of evil and lots of good. But the thing that makes the oil drip down Zorg's forehead, that is like somewhere in the radio can't hear me gesticulating wildly in the distance. But yeah, so it is sort of ultimately very like it's a hero's journey and all that, but the style of it and the aesthetic of it and the tone of it is kind of what I loved more than anything growing up, and I don't think I've ever seen anything like it since.
Why do you think you rewatch it so much? What were you getting out of it?
When I was rewatching it, the score is outstanding. And I'm big into film scores. I kind of bopping around listening to orchestra music all the time. And there's a certain chord to it that I just find really, really peaceful. And there's other things that I kind of watch over the years to help me. I'm not a mad sleeper. So I kind of watch stuff in the evening. And I would have my other thing that helps me go to sleep is the X-Files, which is sort of antithetical to sleep because it's quite scary, but. Similarly, it's got this tone to it, and I don't really know how to describe that in very specific terms. But the fifth element,
like how Twin Peaks has the tone,
yeah, and only when I'm watching Twin Peaks, I have to kind of sit there with my arms around my knees and like my eyes wide.
Yeah,
I got a box set of Twin Peaks when I was 16 from my dad after a breakup, and he was like, "That'll cheer you up." And it was the first six episodes, and it was before sort of torrenting or downloading, and I had only had these six episodes of it to watch. I'm actually writing a thing for the Gloss about that, so stay tuned. But the tone of The Fifth Element, well, that's hard to describe. I feel like I think that Bruce Willis's voice has a really interesting cadence to it, and the way the scripting works is very pleasant. There's just something very pleasant about it, and that is what, that would be my rain sound effect, you know, or my thunder in the distance.
Or whale songs. Or
whale songs, yeah. And once you get so used to something, you're like, oh, no, this is...
It's like okay. My friend... She used to put 30 Rock on DVD and put the volume on really low, and it would be the only thing that could get her to sleep because she couldn't sleep when it was quiet, which I think is like so weird because I love it when it's really quiet. It's the only time I can sleep. But she would have like Jack and Liz like really low in the background, and then she'd just nod out.
They're your buddies, yeah. No, I'd be the same. My other ones would be like Red Dwarf or Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the BBC Radio series. There's lots of just really lovely. It's not ASMR, you know, like people massaging your head or like slowly crinkling paper. It's just other landscapes that are really pleasant to tune into.
You said you kind of stopped watching it then for a while.
Yeah.
Did you just like, do you think you grew out of it or you moved on to something else? Or
life changed. I moved out of my parents' house and I moved to Galway and I started watching documentaries instead, but it always kind of lingered with me as something that was really important. And like the way, I guess I continue to watch things like The X-Files and I continue to revisit it and revisit things like Twin Peaks because they're in the cultural eye and there's something you can talk to other people about. There's something that kind of, there's a certain knowledge that other people have of these shows and the sort of
like a bonding.
And it's something you can have the chats about, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas kind of saying to someone, oh, did you ever see The Fifth Element? Guess how many times I've seen that movie. That's actually real off-putting for people because people don't know it or they're like, really? The one with Chris Tucker? Because that's the one people remember him for some reason. So it's just something that kind of fell out of the loop of my life. But when you asked me to do this, it's like, well, what's one thing that's really influenced you? I was like, oh my God, The Fifth Element. You know, it holds this huge space for me. And I don't, and again, it's like falling in love with anything. It's very hard to nail exactly why. But it's just always been there.
Because your book, that's Spare and Found Parts, is sci-fi.
It right? is, yeah.
It's can you see The Fifth Element in it? Or
I didn't watch The Fifth Element at all during the writing of Spare and Found Parts. And funnily enough, the structure, the thing, like I said earlier about The Fifth Element, is that it's a very sort of traditional man on quest. The item that he has to retrieve is the beautiful woman.
Yeah.
Cough. Like there's a lot, it's very patriarchal, even though it's really subversive in that it's very camp and it's quite a queer text in other ways. What I was trying to do with Spare and Found Parts was actively disrupt that and actively refuse to take part in that kind of storytelling, because I'm kind of, as much as I love Bruce Willis as a sort of a hard-nosed, exhausted ex-major, I feel like I've known enough heroes like that. So Spare and Found Parts is about a young woman who in 100 years from today in Dublin, after the destruction of society, there's give or take as many people in Dublin as there would be at Electric Picnic. It's about a young woman who builds herself a partner out of a forbidden computer and pieces of other people's bodies, biomechanical limbs. So it's her meets Frankenstein meets Children of Men, basically. And one of the things that brought me to it was that I don't feel that there are enough stories in the world about women who make and women who have agency around the things that they create without being mothers. And Fifth Element is not a feminist work. There's not a shred of it in it.
No.
I mean, Mila Jovovich is terrific and the role of Lily was really captivating, but she's a passenger. And she's all powerful and she's perfect, but there's purity politics that happen in there as well. Like, just because she's lovely and nothing terrible happens to her doesn't mean that it's not kind of
like
icky.
When Bruce Willis and Ian Holm are talking about her, like, she's not, they always talk about her like she's not there and can't hear them. They're like, oh, she's perfect. And she's like, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just like, it's just, I find that really weird because I'd never seen it before. And I was like, it's like she's the main thing, but she's like behind the glass wall. Like,
the first woman we see in the film is naked. You know, like I'm always like, I feel like this radar that I can't ever switch off is just that. But how many women are talking?
Once you see it, you can't unsee it from everything, though.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
And even with something you love very much.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't have been aware of that at the time.
No, I just thought I really wanted to have orange hair and run around.
Has that been hard to reconcile, like rewatching it with your different outlook on the world and like patriarchal stuff and stuff?
Yeah, it has been difficult, but I think that there are things that I see in it now with the sort of a critical gaze that I didn't see the first time, like how incredibly subversive Ruby Rod is. So Ruby Rod is Chris Tucker's character, who's a radio host, and he kind of leaps around during the latter half of the film, causing trouble. And he's phenomenal and he's hyper camp and hypersexual, and his body is really interesting, his costuming is fascinating, and the wigs that they have him in are amazing. And he's sort of a bit like Prince in the way that he kind of almost transcends gender because he's extremely feminine.
No, Prince was meant to be. It was supposed to be Prince, Mel Gibson, and Julia Roberts. Mel Gibson was going to be like Bruce Willis, and Julia Roberts was going to be Lulu.
I would watch that. I would watch that sort of alternate universe. Yeah.
Just like slightly flipped. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I would. I really would.
But that's mad that you said that because I was reading about it today and it was like Prince, he said he pulled out, like he signed on in 92 and it took so long to get made that he pulled out for some other reason. But that's, yeah.
That's amazing. Well, he's Prince-like in that sort of sexually ambiguous, but also sexually aggressive, but without appearing unpleasant.
Like Frankenfurter.
Completely like Frankenfurter, and all the scenes, all the sex scenes in it, other than the final shot of the film, is like, oh, come on, guys, you know what I mean. But the all of the sex scenes in it, this sequence where Bruce Willis and Mila Jovovich are leaving planet Earth to go on to this final stage of the quest, like leaving the light world, going into the dark world, going to finally gather the four magical stones, which each represent an element, and when they're all gathered together with Mila Jovovich, we'll save the world, right?
It's like Zelda.
Spoilers, totally like Zelda. Yeah. I have Zelda tattoos, man. I'm really predictable. Like, get out of town.
Ellen has just showed her also her Zelda tattoo.
All right, hang on. Taking my shoes off.
Take this out. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I have the Ocarina of Time on my left foot and the Fairy Ocarina on my right foot. And no regrets. But yeah, so the structure of it is very, very traditional in that way. So when they're leaving the light world and going into the dark world and heading off to the to Flotsam Paradise, which is where the rest of the film takes place, they go on this massive intergalactic spaceship and these beautiful air hostesses.
I love their costumes.
They look like perfume bottles.
Yeah.
And freckles. They've all got freckles and white hair. Like, it's very, very interesting and very diverse cast as well. And there's this sequence where Ruby Rod is kind of giving it loads with an air hostess. But, like, he's giving her loads and she's just enjoying it. And there's this, it's super subversive because. In what film have you seen recently when there's been like a scene of, oh my God, I'm barely here 10 minutes and I'm like, so, but yeah, no, he's going down there in one of the compartments. And when do you ever see that on cinema? Ever?
That was like,
or in science fiction.
You know, Blue Valentine?
Yes.
Everyone was giving out about that because like there's a way different reaction to men getting like blowjobs compared to like women getting gone down on. It's like, grosser apparently to people. They're like,
so disappointing.
Like, The Good Wife had a scene like that as well, which was huge controversy, where she's like split up with her husband and he comes back and she lets him go down on her in the bathroom, and it's kind of, it's a really hot scene, like, but it's network television.
Yeah,
like, no, but it's like you never ever see it.
Yeah, it's, and it's, well, yeah. you don't actually see the act in the Fifth Element, of course. It's always just alluded to as is everything, but you would imagine in the context of Ruby Rod as this fabulous hypersexual celebrity and these wonderful fawning air hostesses, I mean, realistically in a traditional in the very traditional world that this film is set in,
everybody thinks
you would think these air hostesses are like
gonna be going
party down this beautiful man, but what's actually happening is he's like no, you, and that's wonderful. That's super. And I feel like, honestly, watching it growing up, it definitely impacted me being like, no, hang on now, this is correct,
you know.
So there's something really subversive about that, and also in that he's super camp as well, and his performance of gender is
sexually
really
fluid, kinda.
Super sexually fluid. When do you ever see that in science fiction? I mean, like, that in contrast with Bruce Willis is really interesting, and there's a lot of backlash around the time, and culturally still kind of is a lot of backlash around Chris Tucker's role, and that was like, oh, he's so annoying. I'm like, no, campness is, it disrupts what.
Yeah,
gender, and
hetero people find stuff like that hard to deal with when it's a narrative that they're used to seeing play out in a certain way.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Yeah.
And and Bruce Willis absolutely can't stand him.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's really interesting to me as well, because he's
still wearing a really tight orange vest.
Oh, dude, I still think he's kind of hot, man. I'm sorry.
Oh no, he is. No, he is kind of hot. Like, absolutely not. No, he's just like John
McClane. Still got lots of hair. Yes, he's basically like, right off the back of John McClane into outer space.
Yeah, he's like, he just woke up and he's like, oh shit.
Oh, here we go again. Here's my cigarette and I'm talking to my mom on the phone, you know, like putting a photograph of his ex-wife down on the dresser, you know, like it's, and that's where it meets noir.
Yeah.
And
that's such a cool observation. I never thought of it that way.
My wonderful husband, Kerry, Siebels, at Siebels on Twitter. he said that to me this morning when we were watching. And he was like, you know, it's kind of like a noir. And I was like, yeah, it's exactly like a noir. So I have no idea where we started. But yes, it's like a noir.
It's weird that it's kind of, like you said, it's kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It was huge at the time.
Yeah, it was really
it got
exceptional.
So much hype.
And the budget was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like 70 million or something.
And crazy. for the time, that's a lot.
Yeah.
It was the most expensive film ever made outside America. I did a lot of
IMDb-ing, so yeah. Gentle yeah. IMDb-ing around.
And Bassan operated the camera a lot of the time himself.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I loved Leon as well. And I think that's a noir,
mm-hmm.
you know? Mm. Like, I think there's elements of that within there too. And I don't think it's a very un-American film. And the way that it treats its American protagonist is very there's some othering there happening.
Yeah,
as well,
it's
I
cool.
As well.
I wonder why I wonder what drew Bruce Willis to sign on to it. Like, what did he like about it? Because it just seemed like outside of his comfort zone completely compared to what he'd done before the couple of years beforehand.
He was kind of in the wilderness then.
Yeah,
and it was. I guess it was after Pulp Fiction.
Oh my god!
But
yeah, that's what it was.
Before about Pulp Fiction, like he'd been in like kids' films and like. He's weird Disney sex thrillers.
Disney sex thrillers?
There's a Disney sex
Tell me more, Alan.
It's my new brand. Disney sex
my new
thrillers.
Brand.
It was called like Color of Night or something. I can't remember, but it was like...
Gently
like
types
articles.
Into phones
yeah.
notes for
like
later.
Articles
reference.
In like the Daily Mirror about Bruce Willis's controversial new film and stuff. I remember because I used to do the Daily Mirror because my parents bought it like when I was like 8 or 9.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but like it was a huge deal. And he hadn't been an action star really.
What was it called again?
I think it was called Color of Night.
Color
I think.
Of Night.
But yeah, but he hadn't been a star, like an action star, for a while then.
Well, it's innate in him, I suppose, isn't it? Like a lot of how he holds himself. And I kind of wouldn't be really mad into Die Hard. I'm not one of these like Die Hard Christmas jumper people. It's not really kind of my bag. But I think that I think observing him in isolation in that film, which I largely did, I know I have him in the other things as a reference point, but I don't like love him in other things. I'm not like into the other film, his other work, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is just one weird film that he happened to show up in for me.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I have a lot of affection for him in that context.
His physicality is good.
Yeah,
the way he moves himself. He's like a tank.
Yeah, he's all shoulders and sort of his neck is real broad.
He's a bit hot, like.
Yeah, yeah, no, you would. I absolutely would. Like, the more you think about it as well, because again, he's still got like blonde hair.
Yeah,
and, like
he isn't like as craggy as he is now.
Yeah, he's not an old man. He's kind of a young man.
Yeah.
And
hot dad
a little but like he's like a hot like he's like a mid-30s hot dad. He's like I used to work in a bookshop and every so often dads would come in like with small toddlers and like the other women in the store would like all gather together in a terrible week and gaggle and like it's the dad in the store with the child.
I used to work in an ice cream shop on Lake Street and
mercy.
Like hot dad central
tiny children Bruce Willis is like a sprog puttering around like but so he's interesting in that binary as well because he's not I guess he is in terms of like the hero, the sexy hero, hard nosed detective, because of his costuming, as well. Like he wears a luminous orange is the sort of the tone of the film between Lulu's hair and her costume includes it, and his shirt is luminous orange. He's not exactly wandering around in a trench coat and a fedora. Like he's a taxi driver.
You said that orange is like the color of the film and like Lulu's hair and stuff, and you have red hair.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is some sort of correlation there at all?
Oh, goals.
Yeah.
Oh, absolute goals. Goals forever. This is not an accident. This is sort of Scully meets Lulu for the rest of my life. I'm very predictable. I feel like I'm just like, the women who I watched in cinema and television growing up, I absolutely chose bits of their looks to kind of plaster onto myself as I got older. And it's sort of... like it's aspirational ginge. Like I'm so far from being like I have dishwater hair, but I guess between Scully and between Lulu, more Lulu in college, I was much brighter in college, and now I'm kind of transitioning into a Scully as I get older. But definitely like that aesthetic is on the nose.
Mila's hair, like even I feel like that micro fringe is like a thing now a lot. Like, it's kind of had
like
a
Grimes
resurgence.
Kind of in,
yeah. Oh, she's super Grimes, man. Yeah,
yeah.
She's
yeah, completely. Just kind of like ratty looking, but in a nice way. Like,
but you know, they destroyed her hair during. Yeah, yeah. They bleached it from its natural color. There was no Olaplex in those days, guys. No. Tell you that much.
Argan oil was still just in the little fruit thing.
Yeah, it was away from us. Far from argan oil, we were raised. But
Johnson's baby for me.
Oh my Christ! Years. Oh, tell me about it. Yeah, they burnt her hair. They burnt her hair off, so it's a wig for half film.
Oh,
yeah.
I wonder, is there a point where you can tell that it's a wig?
There actually is, because I did read that fact earlier this morning. Her first scenes when she's in the bandages and on the side of the building, the really iconic scene is where she jumps off the edge. She jumps off the side of the government buildings and into oncoming traffic and lands in Corbin Dallas's, Bruce Willis's car. But there's this great sequence of her walking along the side of the building, and she's just because she is she's not sexualized. She's objectified in a way, and the scientists who kind of bring her out of this relic and conjure her forth from a piece of steel immediately objectify her as soon as they've created her, which is super complicated and something I do kind of try and answer in the novel that I was working on about, can you make something in order to desire it, and where there's something grey there that I'm not really sure about, and I think it could be explored more, especially when it's men creating a woman. Mm-hmm. Like, in my case, it's a woman creating a man. But
they were surprised that it was a she.
Oh, of course they were.
They were like,
I default to male, I'm sorry. Yeah. You know? Like,
they're like, and that's the main one, surely.
But immediately there's this disgusting gag where, like, the army general's like, I'm just going to have to take a few photos for the archives. And it's like, yeah, literally get away from me. And that wouldn't have jarred with me growing up.
Yeah.
But now I'm like,
probably because when you were like, what age were you when you saw it? You probably weren't aware of like sexual politics as a concept.
Oh my
at
god,
all.
Not at all. There was no Tumblr when I was 15, man. Do you know, it was a different world. Like, we were learning
my
space
or die. You know,
not even. Not dude, even. This is pre then, yeah. Man. Like, oh my god. Forums. I was a moderator of a Pokemon forum from when I was like 12 onwards. You know,
I was
this?
Moderator of a Waterford metal forum.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Did you used to have long hair?
Yes.
A
long hair in transition year, but it just grew perfectly straight and then got a little kink at the end.
Ah, nice.
Cut it off.
Jesus.
I'm just blessed
apparently.
With straight, very, very straight hair.
Oh, you're so lucky.
And long eyelashes and fast growing nails that grow.
Your keratin is just stunning.
Stunning keratin levels. It's a great gene pool.
Yeah.
Excellent gene pool.
I'd love to have straight hair, like if I wanted. Mine's just all fluffy. This is not to do with the film, sorry.
The hair battle's real. I mean, I'm sure Lilu was just like, God, my strange orange dreads, what?
Separated into sections like that.
And Bruce Willis was a wig as well.
Does he? Was he bald at that point?
He would have been bald by then, I think, yeah.
That's so upsetting.
He was bald in Pulp Fiction, so.
Oh, man.
Mm. Yeah. And
the illusion is broken.
Yeah. You know what's weird?
You're like, I hate this film.
You have seen Die Hard, but you don't really rate it.
I
love
Die recall Hard. Having seen Die Hard at some point in my life.
It's a very fun
Because they
film.
Are, it's almost like he's kind of trying to recapture Die Hard, because it is like even he's wearing a vest again.
There's mirroring, for sure.
Yeah, and it's like working class guy turned into a much bigger thing against the capitalist. Because Alan Rickman is just about money in Die Hard as well.
So Alan Rickman
is very and very little crossover between the villain and the hero as well in Die Hard.
Yeah, because Gruber is like
he's off in an office.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
The whole thing.
Whoa. Maybe they are. Maybe I should go back and watch them and kind of
Die Hard is actually a great film. It's so good.
Like it is kind of tainted a bit by all the people going, oh, best Christmas film ever. But
yeah,
it's like,
you
no,
see,
it's just,
I get
it's a really good film.
But that's just that's just people ruining things, and that just happens.
I get real spiteful around things like that. I'm like, oh, do you think this is
you want to be a contrarian? I'm the same. I'm like, oh, does everyone think this? I'm gonna not.
Yeah. I'm just like, no, I'm gonna go over here and watch another episode of the X-Files again.
It's like when people ask you if you've watched, you know, when you're at a party and like lads are like, have you watched Breaking Bad? You're like, no. And they're like, what do you watch? And I'm like, I'm rewatching Gilmore Girls. And they're like, ooh, they get so angry.
But Breaking Bad is literally the greatest piece of television ever. Like, I can't. I just 100% have no capacity for it, because people won't entertain your reasons for finding it boring. I have tried to watch several of those sort of. I've watched a good deal of True
Iconic
Detective.
TV.
But True Detective has all the women in True Detective are either sex workers, teenage sex workers, or wives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can't unsee it. I'm like, well, they're not speaking to me. I don't care. Oh, is it about masculinity?
That's Get, really
so is everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what I will say for The Fifth Element is that it is about masculinity in some ways, but it's actually just so fast-paced that it's an adventure story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas long, reflective, drawn-out conversations about the nature of the masculine experience of the universe is just something, when I start hearing it, it's like, you know, when you just
zone
turn
out.
static.
Yeah. It's kind of. But like, I think The Fifth Element, even though it's about similar things, because the world that it's set in is so far removed from the real world, you don't think about it in that way as much, so you can enjoy it.
Yeah. It's a romp. It's super camp. For me, I kind of would liken it to the early sort of Batman years. I was talking to my husband about
Adam
this morning.
Adam West Batman?
No. But we're talking sort of Tim Burton era, which is my favourite Batman. Mm. And I can't watch any recent era Batman at all.
You're not into Nolan Batman.
It makes me so specifically angry that I probably shouldn't start talking about it. I have regularly gotten in trouble about this because I just think it's...
This is a safe space to not like Nolan Batman.
With
a
Z.
It's just trash. Like, it's just like a dude looking in the mirror sucking his own dick. Like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care. I want hopping around rooftops with capes and I want to escape for 5 minutes from the grueling grittiness of reality. I don't want to be like... Yeah.
That's why I don't want to watch Breaking Bad. I'm like, I'm going to watch Parks again.
I'm off.
Yeah,
and
see us.
That's fine, and great art does need to be challenging, but I think there is a sort of a trend and tone
at the
moment.
Same challenge all the time.
And we're having the same conversation again and again, and I would much rather Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze saying stupid things than I would Christian Bale standing on a pole in the middle of the different parts of the distance thinking about how hard his life is
time
being
is
a millionaire.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Time is a...
Fair play.
You know, like, thanks, dude.
Yeah.
You know, I think...
Are all those prostitutes still dead? Okay.
Yeah, I'll just watch you as a male stripper instead. Thanks very much. All right. That's all. Like, time is a flat circle. Let's go, boys. Like, I just feel very jaded at this point, and I do think that there are amazing stories out there to watch, and there's incredible art out there to consume and to experience and to become emotionally richer by. But whenever I come up against a dead end, like True Detective or Batman or anything like that, like it just disheartens me as a person who makes art and as a person who loves art and loves film. I stopped watching film for years. I've only started one of my 2016 resolutions was to watch more films because I had lost my ability to enjoy them because I'm sitting down and the checklist starts and then the checklist leads up to the conclusion that this wasn't made for me. Okay.
Yeah, like I choose my films a lot more carefully now than I would have before, especially during college. Like, I had a really good lecturer that would like show us a lot of films with like queer subtract and stuff, and that was something that I'd never experienced, so I never got to relate to stuff like that. I had to like make my own stuff in like normal heterosexual media, whereas being shown this stuff that was sort of like, this is an intentional subtext, which like I always think that's really cool. Like stuff like melodrama films from like the 50s where it's like there's some really gay stuff happening but they don't talk about it at all. It's really
interesting.
But
it's there for you and it's there to
someone being like,
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah. It's like, this is you too.
Yeah.
And that means, I mean, and I grew up in a Nintendo kid. I played a lot of video games growing up and I loved science fiction and love science fiction. But now that I'm in the bizarre and wonderful position where I get to make that stuff, I'm just like, no, but I'm not going to put it under the covers. Like, I'm not going to put this low. This is very on this. I'm not going to have anyone scrambling for subtext or hoping that maybe these two girls feel this way about each other.
But that's really cool because that's only something I think that's happening in the last while because it, like, especially when I was younger, it just wasn't there.
Progress, you know, slowly we'll get there. But The Fifth Element, the one thing I did think that I was when I was watching it, I was like, man, if I what would make this truly great is if Corbin Dallas, Ruby Rhodes, Vito Cornelius were women and Lilu was a dude.
Oh my god, who would you cast?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
Who'd you cast?
Lilu, okay. Corbin, I would say like
Adam Driver for Lilu.
Oh my god, Adam Driver. Tilda Swinton for Zorg.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I just want Tilda Swinton, Jean-Baptiste Emmanuel Zorg. Kind of Tilda Swinton. Phenomenal, yeah.
I don't know. Who would I have for Corbin?
It's a really tough one because you like
You don't get those kind of roles, so you can't imprint anybody onto it.
But maybe somebody like Nicole Kidman.
Oh my god.
Or Kate Blanchett, I was thinking.
Because she's very good and glacial and icy and stuff.
Yeah.
She'd be good. I think Emily Blunt could be good. Or Kate Blanchett.
Blanchett gets cast in so many super masculine roles, though. I mean, Carol, I saw her this year, and she was wonderful as this old, like, she was beautiful, but I think her her arena is sort of genderqueer in itself, you know. Mm.
That's true.
Because she's played Dylan too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know.
That's true, yeah.
So I want hyper feminine, you know.
Okay.
Like I want the girls' ponytails.
Okay.
Kate Bosworth.
Like Matsu's. Like,
yeah, yeah, Matsu's. Absolutely. Yeah. 100% yeah. Hollywood Hunzos. That's it. Like.
I'm trying to think who'd be good. Imagine if you got like fucking like Jennifer Lopez to play Corbin or something, like some really super.
That would
glam.
Be incredible. Yeah. Someone hyper glam.
Yeah.
Or
like Kerry Washington.
Kerry Washington. Yeah.
Okay. Bam. Kerry Washington. Yeah. For Urban Dolls. Adam Driver for Lulu, because I'm just gonna continue to objectify him.
Oh, he's weirdly hot. I can't. I
so confusing.
Like, yeah.
I don't know what I feel. Maybe I'll never know what I feel. I don't
Is
know.
It because of his character in Girls?
No, no, he's a monster in Girls. Can't watch Girls. I watched one episode of Girls and was like, oh, is that my bone that I can see? Oh, look at my, oh, all my nerve endings. No, I'll never watch this again.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
Can't do it. Like Lena Dunham lying on the floor of her parents' apartment going, I'm the voice of my generation. And I just turned the TV off. I was like, nope.
I don't like it. It annoyed me when people I liked related to it, because I was like, who are you?
I mean,
no one on that show is nice.
The problem with Girls is the same as the problem with Dunham. There's only one of it.
Yes.
There should be more.
Yeah.
That's the main problem.
Broad City is a better representation of gal palship, I think.
Yeah.
Praise be Broad City.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I don't think I've seen anything like it in years. I don't think I've laughed authentically at anything in years as I have at that, at Abby and Alana. But I'm trying to think who I would cast for Ruby Rhodes. Maybe like Laverne Cox.
Lupita Nyong'o.
Lupita? Oh.
Yeah.
Lupita in comedy, huh? Ooh.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
She would cut loose.
Yeah, maybe she'd be happy to be given the chance to do that, you know?
Who knows? Who else would we have? Who would be Vito Cornelius older and fabulous?
Judi Dench. She's saying the default for older and fabulous.
What about Mirren?
Mirren. The age thing is such a problem as well, because there's only there's so few actors of a certain age.
There's like 10 that are like older female actresses,
and they keep putting them all in the same movies together. They're like, here's the Marigold Hotel. Oh, look at all these old people. Like, it's so rude. Like, can you have to put them in real parts? Like, but you know, I would like to see a switched out version of it.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see more switched out science fiction. I would like science fiction to be about women, but it's not. And I think that being where my mind, maybe my mind has always gone there with it.
Yeah. Were you, obviously then, the new Star Wars, like, you must have been, like, buzzing about, because it was...
Oh yeah, couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
Like,
because I'd never seen any Star Wars, because I was always just like, anyone who talked, I'm really contrarian sometimes, where, like, if someone talks about something enough to me that they want me to watch it, I won't watch it. Like, I'm like, no, like, And then I watched this Star Wars, and like the representation of the film in my head was nothing like I saw. Like, they're actually just fun movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I think it was because people who talked to me about them were so serious, and they made it seem so boring and clinical, when it was actually just like the never ending story or something.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of
It's
way.
A fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I think Rey helped me kind of break into that, because it was like from her point of view, as opposed to if it was from like
Luke.
Just Finn's or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know Star Wars is wonderful, and
you wrote a great essay about
My girls explain Star Wars to you.
Yeah.
That was a time. That was the
Note City.
Oh my god, those notes, man. I got it was shared like 90,000 times on Facebook, and it just went somewhere that I don't think I've ever been on the internet before, to be honest. It was cool. It was nice to be able to have a conversation with more women about science fiction, to be honest. And I feel that I, for a really long time, have wanted to write about science fiction, but I got deterred by the climate online around women having conversations around video games.
Anita Sarkeesian and all that stuff.
I was living in San Francisco during that time as
well.
A lot of I got to know a couple of the lads who run GamerX, which is the queer video game convention. I kind of would glance off that world socially every so often, but the climate is horrific, and it's not as bad now, she says, biting her tongue, but like, I didn't get anybody telling me they wanted to kill me after writing that Star Wars essay, so surely that means I might be able to write one about like Zelda. I don't know, and I would love to write more about science fiction, but I've been deterred by just the climate.
I remember when I was little, before I played any Zelda games, I thought that she was going to be the protagonist, and I remember being really upset because I was like, oh, it's Link, so Zelda doesn't do anything.
I read Zelda as, not Zelda, Zelda is, I read Link as female the whole way.
Wow.
I always put my name in instead of Link. Really?
Yeah. So I've been reading Link as Female my whole life. And will continue to, no matter what they do. And because you're there with Link's back. It's you.
Yeah.
Like, it's a story about you.
Yeah.
And the things that you go through. Like all the best works of fiction are crawl out of the page and kind of become a part of who we are as readers. Or consumers. I mean, I play more video games than I read books. With Zelda, The Legend of Zelda specifically, The Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, because I'm of the right age to have experienced them when I was most open to those things. I felt that I experienced those games in the second person. It was me that it all happened to. And the work, a lot of the work that I produce is in the second person. A lot of my fiction is you walk into a room and you do this, because I think that reaching out of the medium and into the person who's experiencing it
pulls them in a bit.
Pull them in.
Yeah.
Like, actively do it, because break the novel, you know, because video games actively rupture reality in that way. And
it's more immediate. That's cool.
Yeah. And I know I read Link as me. Could be so much hair under that hat.
Yeah. Oh my God. It just could be a top.
The tunic is ambiguous. It's got earrings, you know?
Yeah.
When you're a kid and you're looking to be somewhere and be someone, you'll find it.
Yeah.
They can try and stop you. And I guess it's our responsibility as makers of things to make it easier for them to find it and give them more opportunity and less resistance to find bits of a mirror in the work, you know? I actually wanted to say Ocarina of Time for this podcast because that's my, I guess Majora's Mask is my... That's such a dirty hipster thing to say. Well, actually, I prefer Majora's Mask. I actually prefer the grittier one. But that was of, and I feel like you compared Fifth Element structurally to Zelda. It's a fetch quest.
Yeah.
Go find these things.
Yeah.
All right, I will. Like water, fire, earth, and wind. Come on. Where you heard that before?
Because Zelda's so elemental.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you mean?
So yeah, no, it's it all kind of loops. We tell each other the same stories over and over again, and the structure of these stories overlap onto one another. And like they say, there's only 7 stories, but there's really only one. And ultimately, if you want to boil that down to Bruce Willis carrying Mila Jovovich bridal style through a giant hotel and returning her to the temple where she belongs with the rest of the special rocks, smooching her and showing her the true meaning of love, so she can ultimately like charge the universe with her magical power. Like,
it's a lot of emotional labor for her as a woman.
Like, fair, you know, girl? Like, fine. If that's the one myth, fine. But yeah. I think instead of making me want to be Mila, dyeing my hair red or not, I feel like I still would much rather be Ruby or Corbin.
Yeah.
And I think people who watch, even though it is dated in that way, I think there's enough weirdness in it as a text to find the weird viewers.
Yeah.
And to find the people who are looking for the stuff and bring them in, you know. That's all I got. Sorry, prone to getting real serious about things. Yes, real, it's like turn a left turn. Ah, we're going to serious town. Let's go. Population you.
Before we started recording, you said you don't think it would be made now.
No.
Why do you think that?
Not in the same way. I think the aesthetic of it belongs in its time, and I think the look of a lot of. Well, I don't think it would be made now because they'd rather make Spider-Man Loves Batman with the cameo from Miss Marvel. They, you know, they wouldn't. Yeah. They don't want this kind of work anymore because they have their training. They Hollywood, the system. You know, I think that cinema is moving away from, like in AAA video games, blockbuster movies.
Yeah,
are just feeding down the same kind of thing at the moment. I think incredible films are still being made, and I think that I mean, like I said, I stopped watching films for years and I'm just coming back into that now, but I genuinely don't feel something as weird as The Fifth Element could exist again. The same way I'm not sure if they'll ever remake Brazil, you know. And if it did, it wouldn't look right because it'd be CGI'd out the wazoo. It'd be all presumed. It'd be all performed on a green screen. There'd be no props. It'd be textured and layered and filtered, the equivalent of auto-tuning Ariana Grande's incredible voice into a series of, like, into effectively a beautiful chiptune. Like, it would get touched to a point where you can't see what it is anymore.
Yeah.
And I think what I love aesthetically about
and I love about the mood and the tone. I know tone is such a weird word, and it's one I keep coming back to, because I think that's what I leave pieces of art with, is a feeling and a sensation, and rather than detail. I'm all about texture, man. All about touch and
the vibes.
Yeah, all about the vibes. Yeah. California, 3 years. Yeah. You never really come back.
No.
But it's costuming, and there's makeup, and there's prosthetics, and there's sets, huge sets, and there is absolutely some CGI, but it's all attuned so neatly that the world holds together.
Mm.
And like, to be fair, Star Wars, of course, The Force Awakens' world held together.
Yeah.
But I don't think that they would throw a budget like Star Wars The Force Awakens at
something like The Fifth Element.
At something as super weird as The Fifth Element, even though in many ways it is a very traditional story. Mm-hmm. It's a weird movie.
Yeah.
And I just don't think it would happen. You certainly wouldn't have a scene like Chris Tucker going down on a beautiful, sexy air hostess.
No.
They return to that. Like, you just wouldn't see it. And if you did see it, there'd be 80,000 think pieces dissecting it and discussing it and taking all of the organic joy from it.
Yeah.
So I think if it were to exist again, we would be in a very different ballpark. And it just wouldn't contain the real artistic touches that it did because of the time that it was made in. Like, it's of its time, and in some ways that's its failing, and in other ways that's what makes it like super weird and super great.
Cool.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Sarah Griffin.
Thanks for talking to me, Alan. Hey. And Ellen.
So that was the podcast. This has been Juvenalia. It's part of the Headstuff Podcast Network. If you want to get in contact with us, it's juvenalia@headstuff.org. And please subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher or similar things. And rate us nicely. Thank you very much, and we'll see you soon. Goodbye. Bye, 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 bye.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.